In our study last Wednesday evening, we were talking about the work of the church in the realm of edification. And we had a number of questions and a lot of good comments that were made. And after services, we were talking with some, and a question or a comment really was made regarding a topic that we didn't discuss, and it was suggested maybe it would be a good thing if we threw that out and just had a comment or two on it before we moved on, and I think the question merits that. So I want to do that. The scenario was, let's suppose that you're a member of a local congregation where things begin to be practiced that are wrong. For example, let's suppose that you're a member of a local congregation and it is decided somewhere during the course of this that they're going to build a fellowship hall. I have a kitchen and all these areas for fun, food, and recreation, as we sometimes refer to it. And we gave the scenario last week about the reality of a man that was in that situation, and he had to move his family to be able to worship with a faithful congregation. We talked about that scenario, but the scenario that was suggested by someone was, suppose you are worshiping with the congregation, and they have all of the accommodations for fun, food, and frolic, as it were, but they learn that this is not right. And so they want to stop the practicing of those things, but yet they have these facilities still on the premises. What should you do? Should you leave them, or should you, if you've left, should you come back? And of course, that involves some decisions that each individual must make. But the question can be simply answered, and that is, if they have had facilities that they have learned are now wrong to have, then you disjoint yourself from those things. For example, the question specifically was dealing with a congregation that put in a kitchen. Now, should they learn that this kitchen and fellowship hall and so forth is not right, then what do you do? Well, you take out the kitchen, and surely you can use the room for a classroom to do something that is right. So that's a very simple solution, but it's one that sometimes we need to talk about, because some may ask the question, well, if I'm over here and things change for the better, then what do I need to do? Well, you need to stay there and keep working with it and learn and keep teaching. David? Yeah, well, that involves the question of fellowship, and so we saw the charts on that last week, I believe, and so that's important. We can't be joined to the things that are wrong. I want to talk a little bit tonight, as we begin our study, on the distinction between the individual and the church. I think you'll find that this particular study will answer some of the questions that perhaps you have asked regarding fun, food, and frolic, as I use that terminology, the distinction between what a home can offer and what the church itself is obligated to offer. And we need to learn that there is a distinction. I think first I want to introduce our study just a little bit by making a point or two that we all understand. We know that God has ordained government. We're going to study that in just a little bit. We know that God has ordained the home. And we know that God certainly has ordained the church, as He sent His Son to purchase it with His blood. But we want to see that the responsibilities of each are distinct from the other. For example, the church has no responsibility in the political duties of government. The church is not involved in politicking. That's not the role of the church. The church is not involved in the responsibilities of the secular duties of the home. These are two distinct entities, and they have distinct responsibilities. God has, as far as the church is concerned, He has purposed the church to be a spiritual house. Let's open our Bibles, if you will, please, to 1 Peter chapter 2. 1 Peter chapter 2. In 1 Peter chapter 2, I want to begin reading at verse 1. It says, "Putting away, therefore, all wickedness and all guile, and hypocrisies and envies, and all evil speakings, as newborn babes long for the spiritual milk which is without guile, that ye may grow thereby unto salvation." Verse 3 now. "If ye have tasted that the Lord is gracious, unto whom coming a living stone, rejected indeed of men, but with God elect precious, ye also as living stones are built up a spiritual house to be a holy priesthood, to offer up spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God through Jesus Christ." Dropping down to verse 9. "But ye are an elect race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for God's own possession, that ye may show forth the excellencies of Him who called you out of darkness into His marvelous light, who in time past were no people, but now are the people of God, who had not obtained mercy, but now have obtained mercy." I want you to notice specifically in verse 5 and in verse 9 that the people of God are set forth as distinctive from any other people. They are called a spiritual house. They are called a holy priesthood. They are called a royal priesthood, verse 9, an elect race, a holy nation, a peculiar people, if you're reading from the King James translation, a people for God's own possession, if you're reading from the American Standard. But what we see in these statements is that there is a distinction made relative to the church. It's to be different. It is a spiritual house. It has a holy function. And the failure to understand that and to apply the very distinctions that we're going to be talking about tonight has been the source of untold confusion and misunderstanding about the mission of the church. Now, I have the words, "the high and holy mission of the church," and they're there for a reason. When we think of the purpose of the church, whatever it does, let me underscore that, must fall under the umbrella of the purpose for which Christ died. Now, that's an important statement. Christ did not die so we can get together and have pious suppers. Christ did not die so that we can take the funds that the church has collected and build a gymnasium. My point is a simple one, that the church is a distinct entity. It has distinct responsibilities. Now let's notice once again, this title on this chart is going to be seen a number of times. The individual Christian has responsibilities in government, in the home, and in the church, but they are not the same. Let's notice, if you will, first of all, in Romans, the 13th chapter. God ordained civil authority. Romans, the 13th chapter. Let's begin at verse 1. Romans, the 13th chapter, verse 1. The Apostle Paul writing said, "Let every soul be in subjection to the higher powers, for there is no power but of God. And the powers that be are ordained of God. Therefore he that resisteth the power withstandeth the ordinance of God, and they that withstand shall receive to themselves judgment. For rulers are not a terror to the good work, but to the evil. And wouldest thou have no fear of the power? Do that which is good, and thou shalt have praise from the same. For he is a minister of God to thee for good. But if thou do that which is evil, be afraid, for he beareth not the sword in vain. For he is a minister of God, an avenger for wrath, to him that doeth evil. Wherefore, ye must needs be in subjection, not only because of the wrath, but also for conscience' sake. For this cause ye pay tribute also, for they are ministers of God's service, attending continually upon this very thing. Render to all their dues, tribute to whom tribute is due, custom to whom custom, fear to whom fear, honor to whom honor. Now there are a lot of things in this context that we might choose to discuss that's really outside the scope of the things that I want to direct our study toward. But just the reading of this passage, we see very clearly that civil authority exists by the authority of God. Now that doesn't mean that every decision that civil authorities make is in keeping with God's will. But the arrangement of civil authority, God has ordained that. And as God has ordained that, the instructions of the apostle to the individual is what? What are you to do with civil authority? Randy?
I always heard it said, obey the laws of the land.
Well, yeah. And there is an exception. What is it? When it violates God's law. And of course, those of you in our Acts study know exactly where that's found, right? We must obey God rather than men. Well, chapter 5 and 4, but it's in chapter 5. Chapter 5, that statement. It's in chapter 4 and 5 where the context is being considered. But what we see is that the individual has a responsibility to the government because the powers that be are ordained of God. You pay taxes. Why do you pay taxes? Do you pay taxes because you grant your approval to everything that the government does with your money? Well, no, but you pay taxes because that's the law. And so you subject yourself to paying taxes because if you don't, they come and get you. Something like that. But for conscience sake, you know that that's wrong. All right? Peggy?
Let's see, in
Well, that's true.
That's true.
That's true. So we have an obligation to submit to civil authority even if they demand taxes. We must do that. And 1 Peter chapter 2 in verses 13 through verse 17 simply amplifies that. It teaches the same thing. In 1 Peter the second chapter, beginning at verse 13, the writer says, "Be subject to every ordinance of man for the Lord's sake, whether to the king as supreme, or unto governors as sent by him for vengeance on evildoers, and for praise to them that do well. For so is the will of God, that by well-doing ye should put to silence the ignorance of foolish men, as free and not using your freedom for a cloak of wickedness, but as bondservants of God. Honor all men, love the brotherhood, fear God, honor the king." Now, these statements are powerful statements. And as we read these, sometimes we think that that's always easy. Now, in our own political arena, we find that some of those things are not easy. But suppose you existed in the entity where the Roman king demanded certain things of you, and if you didn't do that, then you might be separated from your family, you might lose your job, you might lose your life. Now, would it be as easy to honor the king? Now, that's what the text commands. Honor the king. Now, I've talked with a lot of folks. Bruce, you've been in the military. Some of you have. You may have a superior that you don't like. You have no regard or respect for his lifestyle. But when you meet him, you pop your heels together and salute him, don't you? Now, why do you do that, Bruce? Yeah, it's because he's got these things on his arm up here. Up here, maybe some on his collar. Yeah, well, you do that, don't you? Now, why? Not because you respect the person of the man, but the uniform, the role that he has. And so this text says, honor the king. Now, it's not my purpose or intent to dive into that as deeply as we could, because what we're trying to show is distinctiveness in roles and responsibilities. You, as a Christian, you have, as a Christian, a responsibility to the government. But you, as a Christian, also have responsibilities to your home. Now, in Ephesians, the 5th chapter, beginning at verse 22, we see that there are separate roles in the home. And God has ordained this. In Ephesians chapter 5, verse 22, the writer says, "Wives, be in subjection unto your own husbands, as unto the Lord. For the husband is the head of the wife, as Christ also is the head of the church, being himself the Savior of the body. But as the church is subject to Christ, so let the wives also be to their husbands in everything. Husbands, love your wives, even as Christ also loved the church and gave himself up for it, that he might sanctify it, having cleansed it by the washing of water with the word, that he might present the church to himself a glorious church, not having spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that it should be holy and without blemish. Even so, ought husbands also to love their own wives as their own bodies. He that loveth his own wife loveth himself. For no man ever hated his own flesh, but nourisheth and cherisheth it, even as Christ also the church, because we are members of his body. For this cause shall a man leave his father and mother, and shall cleave to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. This mystery is great, but I speak in regard of Christ and of the church. Nevertheless, do ye also severally love each one his own wife, even as himself, and let the wife see that she fear or reverence her husband. Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honor thy father and mother," which is the first commandment, "with promise." Verse 5 says, "Servants, be obedient unto them that according to the flesh are your masters, with fear and trembling, in singleness of your heart, as unto the Lord." And if you'll notice, beginning at verse 9, "And ye masters," we see instructions given to them. Now here we see a household environment that might involve a man, his wife, his children. We might even see a master-servant relationship in that household. We see that there are different roles in that household. The wife is to have a role of submission. The husband is to have a role of headship. But let me ask you, folks, when the man is overseeing his family as a husband and fulfilling that responsibility, does that then mean that the church is overseeing his family? Well, no. Here is a distinctive role that he has in the family. The church is not overseeing the family. We see then that his role is individual in that relationship. Someone who is involved in politics, and maybe you pick out your favorite political figure and you go to campaigning for him. Does that then mean that because you're exercising a privilege that you have in support of civil government, does that then put the church in the campaigning business? Well, then you see that in the political arena, an individual has a responsibility to submit to civil government. A part of that might be in the election or promotion of certain officials. But that doesn't mean that the church now is in the business of selection or the promotion of certain officials, does it? We see that in the family, each individual has a unique responsibility. But that doesn't put the church in the business of being the head of your family any more than it puts the church in the role of being in submission to you as the wife is to be, or children, obey your parents. There are different roles. And those roles in the family are individual. Now we see that. That's not difficult for us to see. And we must also see that there are different responsibilities that an individual has then toward the church. The church is a special relationship. It's referred to as a spiritual relationship. Now it's true, and we want to emphasize this, that a Christian will be a better citizen. Why? Because he understands his responsibility to civil government. A Christian will be a better husband, a better wife, a better child, because they understand their relationship before God in that environment or in that relationship. to be a Christian will make you a better boss, a better employee, a better neighbor. Why? Because you understand you have an individual responsibility before God that governs those relationships. So that's a granted point in our study. But because being a Christian makes you better in these relationships does not mean that the church has now become involved either in politics or business as an employee or an employer or any of these other relationships. These are individual. Now, to notice a real distinction in this, I want you to turn in your Bibles to 1 Corinthians, the 11th chapter. 1 Corinthians, the 11th chapter. Oh, there was a point I meant to make, and I overlooked it until I saw it in my notes here. All of these that we're talking about here, all of these, every one of them, are the result of the relationship that we have individually to Christ. Now, let's emphasize that. Every one of these, we become better as a citizen, a family member, and so forth, because we have a relationship to Christ. Now, let's not get that thing turned around and say that because I am a better citizen, a better family member, a better employee, now I have a relationship with Christ. No, sometimes we get that thing turned around, and we get it turned around in almost every realm that the church is to be involved with. Point B. Here are some that think, well, I'll make a Christian out of you because I can entertain you well. I'll make a Christian out of you because, you see, we have a better basketball team here than they do down the street. So we're determined through these mediums, we'll use them then to make a Christian out of you. Now, the Lord never used any kind of social or recreational, or did the New Testament church, activities to get people to become Christians. Now, that we want to see. We become better at these things that we have on the board as a result of being a Christian. But that doesn't mean that the church is to be involved in these things. All right, let's take that step a step further. In 1 Corinthians, the 11th chapter, we see that the church at Corinth had a great problem. Well, it had many great problems, but they had a problem with the observance of the Lord's Supper in the 11th chapter. And if you'll notice, beginning at verse 17 of 1 Corinthians chapter 11. 1 Corinthians chapter 11, verse 17. Paul writes, "But in giving you this charge, I praise you not, that ye come together not for the better, but for the worse. For first of all, when you come together in the church, I hear that divisions exist among you, and I partly believe it." Now let's talk about verse 18. Paul said, "I hear that when you come together in the church." Now how is Paul using the word church? All right, it's the assembled body of Christ. Do you see that? It is the church in Corinth. You'll notice Paul addresses that epistle, 1 Corinthians, to the church of God which is in Corinth. But the term church used in 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 2 is used to identify that body in Corinth. Here we see the term church used to refer to their assembled capacity. You're come together in the church. There are things that you do together. And as we see in this text, he says, "I praise you not." Well, why? There are factions among you. In verse 20, he says, "When therefore you assemble yourselves together." Now that indicates that there was a coming together of those who were Christians, those who made up the church in Corinth. Now when they came together, they would function and work as a local church. But yet we see in verse 22, he says, well, verse 21 beginning, he says, "For in your eating, each one taketh before other his own supper. One is hungry, and another is drunken. What, have ye not houses to eat and to drink in? Or despise ye the church of God, and put them to shame that have not? What shall I say to you? Shall I praise you? In this I praise you not." Now I want you to look carefully there at verse 22. Paul says, "What, have ye not houses to eat and to drink in?" Now we've mentioned a couple of times that the word church is used beginning at verse 17 to talk about the church in Corinth in their assembled capacity. when you come together, here's something that you do. And then he raises the question, what, have ye not houses to eat and to drink in? Now the very asking of that question suggests that there is a meeting place where they have come together that constitutes the meeting place of the church in Corinth, and it was distinct from somebody's home. Do you see that? Does everybody see that? That's an important point. When you come together to observe the Lord's Supper, what you're doing is not right. What, do you not have houses to do this? Which suggests that the church in Corinth had come together, and they had come together in some kind of a meeting place that really was not someone's home. Now he's asked the question, what, have you not houses to do this? Go home and do that. Now then he gives them instructions regarding proper observance of the Lord's Supper. And in his conclusion of that, in verse 34, he said, if any man is hungry, let him eat when you come together. Is that what it says? No, that's not what it says. He said, if any man is hungry, let him eat at home, that your coming together be not unto judgment. And the rest will I set in order whensoever I come. Now, do you see a different purpose when the church has come together versus what they are to do in their homes? Now, we're going to talk about that in more detail in a little bit when we get over to Matthew, the 25th chapter. But the very fact that in this text, as well as many others, the Lord calls something the church, becomes evident that it has some peculiar, distinctive function that belongs to it. Now, does that make a distinction? Am I making that clear? I don't want to leave that hanging. If it's not clear, you raise your hand. Not clear, David? Oh, go ahead. Well, that's true.
So, paying attention to His Word, we can't do what we just want to do and have a party or whatever you call it. We've got to make sure that what we do is in reverence.
Well, that is true. And so what we're trying to establish is to help everyone in the class to see that if we're going to give the proper reverence to God, then we can't assume that because I can do this as an individual, then that gives the church the liberty to do that. So we've got to establish that these are distinctive relationships. And then I think once we've got that done, we can make some applications that will make this whole thing clearer. Bruce? Well, you can't. Yeah. Yeah. The irony of that, Bruce, is that the one thing, maybe I shouldn't just say the one thing, but one thing that God has designed in the church that ought to illustrate our fellowship and unity with the body and the blood of Christ and thus with each other, in this instance, became the dividing wedge between them. Now, that's an irony. John and David.
I guess I've always had trouble with this one. King James Version says, in verse 18, in the church. The American Standard says, as a church. In the as they are both added, so those are just interpreters, I guess.
Well, in verse 18, I'm reading from the American Standard. It says, for first of all, when you come together in the church.
Okay. Well, the New American Standard has as.
Okay. Can't
right.
See it.
We know that church is called out, but it's not a building, so I think as a fits better. So how does this exclude them being in a house if it's as a not in?
I'm not focusing on verse 18 to make that distinction. What I'm focusing on is simply to show that this is some place that they came together. The word church is not used to talk about the place, but the word church is used to talk about the people. But the people have come together. Now, as they have come together, it indicates an assembled capacity. Now, would the church of God exist in Corinth if they were not assembled? Well, now let's think about it. Would there be a church of God in Corinth if they were not assembled? Well, sure there would. We talk about the church in Corinth. They might do their thing in a distributive fashion, right? But here is something they do when they have come together. They are assembled. And so when the writer discusses when you come together in the church, he's not talking about the building, but when the church is assembled, here's something that you're not doing correctly. Correct. That's the point. David, and then Terry, did you have your hand? I thought I saw Terry's. Did you see your hand? Was it up? All right. David and then Dick. Terry's deciding. That's right.
Has said,
yeah, that's right.
If in football, if we run a certain offense, we're running the Delaware wing T. Well, if we're going to really run the Delaware wing T, we're going to do what they did, exactly the way they did it. Now, some people take that offense and put innovations in them and to adapt to their maybe their personnel. But we as Christians, we don't adapt to our personnel, we adapt to God.
That's right.
Standard.
And that's absolute.
And that's where people, they take human things and we adapt this, we adapt that. But you don't adapt God's word. You stay exactly the way He said.
Yeah. Remind me in a moment there was something I was going to say.
It seemed that you'd have to pretty well decide whether you're going to be in somebody's house and drinking and drunk, or whether you're going to have a church under Christian ways.
Well, there's truth to that. But I want to make it clear, in light of what John said, that the church in Corinth has come together. These are things that are being discussed that they did when they came together. And what they were doing when they came together was not eating the Lord's Supper, but they had turned it into their own supper. Now, the point being, if you want to eat your own supper, you go home, which indicates that where they were was not at home. There's a distinction being made. Here's what you do at home, but here you've come together for a different purpose. The purpose is a higher and holier purpose. Go ahead. That's right. And that's the point we're trying to establish. And if we come together to do spiritual things, that shows the church is unique. Its work is unique. It's distinctive. And this becomes very important to our study. That was what it was. I want us to see that in this context, they came together in the church. They came together in an assembled capacity. But even though they came together in an assembled capacity, what they came together to do was something they could do at home, but it was not a function of the church. Now, do we see that? Just a second. I want to see if everybody saw that. All right. All right.
This is speculation, but for the church in Corinth to have come up with the idea to turn the Lord's Supper into a common meal, someone introduced it.
Yeah.
Someone said,
that's not speculation.
Said,
that's just the way that works.
Said, I've got a good idea.
Yeah.
Since we're all gathered together anyway, why don't we just break out the food and we'll have a feast?
Yeah.
And somebody else said, that's a good idea.
Yeah, and it wasn't. That's not a good idea. Let's not do that. Yeah. And we see this distinction in this very passage. What they were doing was turning a home function into a church function. Does that help us a little bit? All right. Yeah, uh-huh. They thought it was, anyhow. Well, let's examine this chart. The individual Christian, he can function in the government, can't he? I knew someone a few years ago, one of the elders of the church where I preached was the county tax assessor. It was an office that he had been elected into that office to serve. And there were some folks who said that a Christian can't be involved in government, can't hold a political office. I responded to that by saying I wish that everybody that held a political office were a Christian. Wouldn't that make a difference? But you see, the point being here is that the individual Christian can function in government. But because this one elder was the county tax assessor, did that mean then that the church had rights to look at all your tax business? No, I didn't put the church in the business of assessing taxes. That was his job. He was the county tax assessor. Well, the individual Christian can function in the home, can be a father, can be a mother, can be a child. And in homes in those days, could be a master or a servant. But the church then didn't become involved in the affairs of that home. Didn't mean the church was the father or the mother or the servant of the master. Now, if you work for a candidate, the church is not campaigning. Shouldn't be. Ought not. Be wrong if he did. Now, if he owns a business to provide for his family, the church is not involved in a secular business. Now, I think we've illustrated that in times past when we talk about the cattle ranch, didn't we? You remember that? Can a Christian have a 200-acre cattle ranch and raise cattle to support his family? Yes, that's a private business enterprise. He can do that for profit, but the church cannot do that. Roy, and then... Well, elders of a local church are supposed to have the responsibility of shepherding the flock. Now, if one of the sheep in that flock is about to be eaten by a wolf, what do you think the elders ought to do? Is it their responsibility to help him? Well, yes. But that doesn't mean then that the elders are running your family. Does that make a difference? Okay. I saw a hand. Yes, David. Well, I appreciate that. I want us to see that. The church has a distinctive responsibility. A good parent has the responsibility of trying to educate his children. And as a parent, is it right and proper for you to provide some kind of social or recreational entertainment for your family? All of us have heard the expression, all work and no play makes Jack a dull boy. I forgot his name. Makes Jack a dull boy. That's right. A good parent understands that all work and no social or recreational life is not proper education for a child. You can't do it that way. Now, I've known some that thought that they could do it that way, but you can't do it that way. A good parent has to provide some means of recreation, some means of relief from the day-to-day work for his family. Now, that does not mean that because an individual may work in a candidate's campaigning, that the church can do it. That does not mean that because as an individual I can buy a cattle farm, that the church can buy a cattle farm. And that does not mean that as an individual parent I am obligated to provide social and recreational interaction for my children, that the church can do it. These are different roles and they're distinctive in their nature. The church is not involved in these so-called family activities any more than they are in the economic or political activities that an individual might engage in. Now, this is not as complicated as it seems. They're just simply different roles, different responsibilities. And the church becomes distinct in its role and its responsibility. Now let's notice what we might call church action. It's important for us to understand what the church is as an entity. The church acts when it acts collectively, from the text of Ephesians chapter 4, verse 9, or verse 4, 16 it is, through that which every joint supplies. Now we've talked about this in the realm of edification, and we've learned that the weakest link of the chain essentially determines the strength of the chain. And so we've noted that each individual Christian is essential to the growth and the strength of a local church. Through that, as we said, through which every joint supplies. But through that which every joint supplies, then the body is able to act. Church action involves a group of individuals acting. Now, this becomes important to us. It does not follow. And I have heard this argument made till I could nearly turn blue, either that or upchuck, because it's just not the same. Folks want to make the argument that whatever the individual can do, the church can do it. Because, you see, the church is made up of individuals. Now, we'll answer that. Terry, go ahead. Well, we're going to get to that. That's true. That's true. That's right. And we're going to talk about James. No, it won't follow. But let's establish what the church is when it acts. When the church acts, we're not talking about one or two or three people doing something in a distributive fashion. We're talking about a collective action. The unit acts. The body acts. One member does not constitute a body. I asked Terry a moment ago, do you see your hand? Well, your hand does not constitute the whole body, does it? Paul drives that point home in 1 Corinthians chapter 12 when he raises the question, what about your eye? If all the body was seeing, then where were the smelling? Well, if all of your body was an eye, then you wouldn't have any use for a nose, would you? But you couldn't smell anything. All you could do is see. You couldn't go anywhere. You couldn't handle anything because your whole body is an eye. Now, there might be cartoon characters like that, but that's not real. The body is made up of many members. It constitutes the entity of the body. It is a collective unit. Now, we talk about building a building. You don't see, at least in this part of the country, much anymore, a building built out of stones or concrete blocks or bricks. But we understand the principle that a building is not the same thing as a brick. It takes many bricks to constitute the building. And one brick does not constitute the building. One stone does not constitute the building. The term church is likewise a collective noun. Now, when I was in school, which at this point seems like only yesterday. What are you laughing at? But when I was in school, I learned some things about nouns and verbs and dangling participles and a whole bunch of things that probably were important then. And that is a collective noun. Is a word that represents a group, like the word flock. When you look up in the sky and you see an old duck flying through the air, what do you say? There goes a duck. You don't say, there goes a flock of duck, do you? Because in order to be a flock, it would have to be a group. Now, when we looked out in the field and we said something about the herd of cattle, we understood very simply that one old cow does not a herd make. That's not proper grammar, but you get the point. One does not constitute the group. And if you're going to use a collective noun like the word church, You're talking about a collectivity of people. Messed you up, didn't it? Yeah, preachers do that. Well, we want to see how that these terms are used. And that answers in and of itself, I'm convinced, a lot of questions. When we see how the term church is used in the Bible, it's used to talk about or distinguish an entity, a group of people. Now, it might be used in a universal sense to talk about this group of people that are called out all over the globe. Or it might be used in a local sense to talk about this group of people that are called out of the world that live in Corinth. Now, we see that. When Jesus said, "Upon this rock I will build my church," He was talking about a group of people that would be called out of the world all over the globe. But when Paul wrote the epistle to the church of God which is in Corinth, he was writing to a called out body of people that lived in Corinth. So we now have locality, but we still have the word used as a collective noun, a body of called out people. Now, we might want to save this till next time, Richard. We're about to get into a new section. Do I have time to even introduce it? That's not much. Well, I'll try to introduce it. We'll go over this next time. But again, to state the difference between the individual Christian and the church as far as action is concerned, keep in mind that individual action cannot be collective action. That's just diametrically opposed to each other. You can't have individual action being collective action. Let's illustrate it. In 1 Corinthians chapter 5 and verse 1, the Apostle Paul recognized a problem and addressed it that existed in the church in Corinth. He said, "One of you hath his father's wife." Now, question, did that mean that the whole church had this man's wife? No, there was one that had this man's wife. An individual in the church had his father's wife. Didn't mean that the whole church was doing this. And in 1 Corinthians chapter 11, when Paul raised the question, "Have ye not houses to eat and to drink in?" Now, when I go home tonight, it's likely that before I go to bed, I'll either eat or drink something. Does that mean that the church now is at my house eating and drinking? Pardon me? Yeah, I bet you will. Yeah. Question, Bruce? All right. Point number 3. When we discuss disciplinary action, we see that if a man sins against his brother, then the man who is sinned against is to go to his brother and say, "You did this to me, and this is not right." And if it can be reconciled, then you've gained your brother. Well, if you can't be reconciled, the text tells us, you take two or three more so that every word can be established. And he says, if that doesn't work, then he says, you tell it to the church. Now, what does that suggest at this point? All right. Now it's becoming a public matter. It's a different responsibility. Here it was an individual responsibility to reconcile. Now it has become the church's responsibility to see to it that this is reconciled. And if not, then he says, let him be unto thee as the publican and there's one more. Tax collector. Well, that wasn't what I meant, but the publicans. So the point being is there is a distinction in what you are to do and the efforts that you are to make before you tell it to the church. Which shows that the church and the individual are not the same thing. All right, we'll stop there and we'll have to start there next time. That's right, thank you. I just drew blank on the publicans and the Gentiles. I hate it when that happens. I told you about preaching in Blytheville, Arkansas, didn't I, one time? We had a house full. In fact, big building and big foyer. And there were people, Big Dan was one. He was sitting out in the foyer. And of all stupid things for me to say, I got up there and I was teaching something that I was going to use John 3:16. And I said, you know, This is a familiar text, sometimes referred to as the golden text of the Bible, John 3:16. Everybody quotes John 3:16, and I started to quote it, and I got a word out of place, and it wouldn't come for anything. And I said, well, everybody but me can quote it. I'm going to have to turn to it for you.
You said the wolf coming after sheep.
If you don't have a copy of Lesson 10, they're up here after services. Come up and get one.